of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, November 29th, 2007, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Journalists decry mainstream media bias in the case of Mumia Abu Jamal. The LAUSD moves to protect student information from the military, and a new performance by Michael Kearns commemorating International World AIDS Day. But I can't help myself, why should I? This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Anti-recruitment activists are hailing the recent announcement by the Los Angeles Unified School District of a new policy to better protect students' personal information from the military. The policy is the result of discussions with teachers and the ACLU. It was approved late last month and just recently made available to district employees. Under the Bush administration's No Child Left Behind Act, public schools are required to make available students' names and addresses to military recruiters upon request. Joining me on the phone this morning is Arlene Inouye. She is with the Coalition Against Militarism in Our Schools. Welcome to Uprising, Arlene.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks very much for joining us. And on the line with us also is Pat Elder with Peace Action Montgomery in Bethesda, Maryland. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you, Sonali.
And the reason we have you on, Pat, is because LAUSD is actually the nation's second school system that has instituted this sort of policy. And in your part of the country, something similar has happened. But first, let's talk about Los Angeles. Arlene, specifically, what does this policy say that the LAUSD has adopted?
Well, what it means, Sonali, is that the military recruiters have been, up until now, getting the privacy information of juniors and seniors who take the ASVAB, which is the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. It is a military test, but it's been given free to schools under the name of career exploration. And they convince the schools and students that this is a tool that they can use to find out what careers they could be suited for. So for years, students have been taking this exam, and they sign a waiver before taking it that states that, you know, they are releasing their scores. And if they don't sign this waiver, their scores will not be they won't get the results, and it will not be used. So they're pretty much forced to sign this waiver, a privacy waiver. And then they take this exam called the ASVAB. It's about a three-and-a-half-hour pretty grueling exam on, you know, different careers on what they're good at. And then after that, the district has given the career advisors the choice of what to do with those scores. There are eight options, and every option except for one will not give the scores to military recruiters. There's also an option that says the scores are invalid. But basically, every option gives the scores to military recruiters. And if the school does not choose an option, by default, it will go to military recruiters. So we had a situation in Los Angeles Unified School District where approximately 75% to maybe 85% of the schools had chosen to give the ASVAB exam. Again, it's voluntary, but they gave it to their students, whoever wanted it. They announced it in different ways on our school campuses. And without many...
Arlene, actually, we're having some trouble hearing you. The phone is cutting out, so we're going to have to call you right back and continue with your answer. But in the meantime, let me move to Pat and ask you to tell us what has been happening in Montgomery County Public Schools in Maryland, where you're from. Is it similar to what Arlene was saying in terms of the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Test being administered, and now your school district has a policy to not make that mandatory?
That's correct, Sonali. In Montgomery County, Maryland, a group of activists approached the school administrators about 2 years ago, and we said that we understood that students, several hundred in Montgomery County, Maryland, were taking the ASVAB test, and they were being forced to sign a privacy waiver by the military that, in effect, had them relinquish private information to the military. The military has a database that tracks more than 25 million youth, and so the data from 3.5 hours of testing is dumped into military recruiting database, which is then used down the road to approach students. And often the students didn't even know that they were taking a military-related exam. So we went to the attorney for the Montgomery County, Maryland Public School Systems, and we said, well, gosh, it seems that this violates Maryland law. I mean, Maryland law pretty clearly states that you can't coerce a minor to relinquish private information without the advice and consent of their parents. Gosh, it took them a year to get back to us, and they said, in effect, that they agreed with us. And so now Montgomery has moved so that, you know, if you take the ASVAB test, you have to have parental permission. And all of the information from the test is precluded from being sent to military recruiters.
I want to turn back to Arlene. We have her back on the line with us. Arlene, we've been talking to Pat to try to get a sense of what happened in Maryland at Montgomery public school system. Is it essentially the same thing that the LAUSD has come up with, saying that students do not have to, if they take this test, do not have to give up their information without their, you know, are not forced to give up their information?
Yes, exactly. And what was really interesting, Sonali, is because I went to the school district as a union representative, UTLA, and as a community representative, we brought people, students, who gave, you know, their information, their reports to the board about experiences with the military on in our school district. And the school district does not know what is going on until they hear from us. They hear from the students, the teachers, the community, the parents.
But isn't it their responsibility to know if they're administering this test?
You would think so, but I was astonished. We uncovered stuff as we were asking questions. For example, the military processing people, the ones who give the ASVAB from the Department of Defense, they had been telling the school district for years, oh, we inform career advisors of the choices, you know, to keep the information private. We found, in fact, they have not been informing career advisors. I talked to career advisors personally, and they said, I've been doing this job for 20 years, and I never heard that the ASVAB was a military test, or I didn't know the scores were given to military recruiters. So we kept giving this information to the school district, and we called the National Lawyers Guild, who made an excellent legal briefing on showing how this violates student privacy laws, federal and state, and is constitutionally, you know, the district's in trouble. It's not what should be done. So the district did reverse itself with this new policy, and they put it into their guidelines, District Policy 2067.1.
Now, I understand that the No Child Left Behind Act, which requires public schools to offer up students information unless they opt out, you know, this is basically something that that CAMS, Coalition Against Militarism in Our Schools, your organization, Arlene, has been working for a number of years to deal with. How does this particular policy of the LAUSD impact the No Child Left Behind Act's provision? And, in fact, was the ASVAB test being used in a way to get that information from students who were opting out?
Well, this is the thing, Sonali. Parents who chose to opt out of military recruiters getting the contact information of their students did not know that their child, if they took the ASVAB, their scores probably in 75% of the cases were given to military recruiters. So it nullifies the opt-out, and that's why it's a violation of privacy and parents' rights. Parents have a right to keep that information from military recruiters, because the state recognizes that this is very critical information, school records, that there are privacy laws to protect parents and students.
I want to turn back to Pat Elder with Peace Action Montgomery in Montgomery County, Maryland. And as I mentioned, the school district there became the first in the country to actually come up with a policy protecting students' information regarding this particular test and the release of information to the military. Specifically, Pat, at this point, what is the policy of your school district regarding the test itself? Are students now still required to take the test, or is the test itself voluntary, or is it just regarding the privacy of the information?
Well, I think in Montgomery County, Maryland, the test has always been a voluntary test. The problem has been that the acronym is typically not explained. So kids say, well, I'm going to take the ASVAB test because my counselor said that it's great for exploring careers. And if you go to Google simply ASVAB, you'll come up with the Career Exploration Program. And there's actually no mention of the United States military on that website. So you need to be careful. I think it's important to put this talk, though, about the ASVAB into a national context. We have 650,000 students taking the ASVAB in public schools every year across the country. It is arguably the United States military's number one recruiting tool. We've also identified schools in 32 states that make mandatory ASVAB testing for all juniors. So if you're a junior, say, in South Dakota, you'll probably be forced to take the ASVAB test. It is a dream for military recruiters to require juniors in high school to come into the cafeteria, say, and unload their heads for 3.5 hours. It's a recruiter's dream because, you know, there's a lot of information gleaned from these tests, and so a recruiter can call a kid after a half year or so, or even in a week if he desires, and, you know, talk to the kid and say, listen, I understand you really did well on the mechanics part of the ASVAB test. You know, we have wonderful career opportunities for you in the United States Army, fixing transmissions and things of that nature. So it's a recruiting tool. 650,000 kids are taking it across the country, and several thousand kids are being forced to do so.
Arlene, turning back to you here in Los Angeles, I understand the policy that the LAUSD has adopted is even broader than protecting students' information via this test, that it also includes the fact that no student now will be required, no student in a public school will be required to meet with a recruiter as well as participate in the JROTC program as well.
Yes, we have a policy bulletin that specifies military recruiters' responsibilities, students' rights, parental rights, and it makes clear, like I said, because, you know, we went to the board knows many of the violations that we told them were going on, and that literally, you know, recruiters were in the school, talking to students personally, sometimes taking them home, and really on them, as well as calling them several times a day. So the district has, I applaud the district for having a policy that outlines the that the students have, they do not have to talk to military recruiters. They tell you to call the commanding officer if you're getting harassed. We can call the district. I continue to get concerns and reports and information from students and parents, and I go after the district and let that be known. We have a policy where we do not allow military vans on our campuses. They have to get prior approval by the Office of Risk Management for safety issues, and so basically this has stopped the military vans coming onto campuses, and we are working really hard to ensure that our students are protected because they are using, you know, military recruiters are using our schools, and they have said that this is their primary recruiting ground to entice students into the military. And students need to be protected, and they need to know their rights, and parents need to know their rights. Hmm. So we're coming down hard on these issues.
Now, doesn't LAUSD's Superintendent David Brewer have decades of experience in the military, I believe in the Navy?
Yes, Admiral Brewer is... has had 20 plus years in the Navy, and he has no educational experience.
Hmm. Did that impact at all your attempts to get this policy in place?
Well, this policy was made with the legal department of LA Unified,
mm-hmm.
with the National Lawyers Guild. So it did not go through the general panel.
Well, what's the next step, finally, Arlene, for Los Angeles and Southern California in general public schools in terms of protecting students from military recruiters?
Well, we're working at all levels, Sonali. We're working in the national level, the state level. But I think of critical importance is the grassroots work in our schools. So we have an Adopt-a-School project where we have 50 schools in L.A. We're working together with students, teachers, parents, community to develop the strategies at that school where we can bring veterans in with Arlington West. We can use social justice curriculum for, you know, the information educational. We can have leafleters there passing out. Student groups can be formed. They can table to counter military recruitment myths or misinformation. We have multiple strategies that we're working at our local school to make sure that students get the information. We have a website, militaryfreeschools.org, that anybody can go to for information on these issues. And together with a national network, NOMI, National Network Opposed to the Militarism of Youth, at NOMI.org, we have a website that has all the issues, Joe, to see ASVAB, opt-out, military recruiting. You can go and see by state what's going on, stories from the ground, and the organizations doing the work.
Great.
We need to do this work united.
Well, I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us today. Arlene Inouye with Coalition Against Militarism in Our Schools and Pat Elder with Peace Action Montgomery. And those websites that Arlene gave out are militaryfreeschools.org and nomi.org. That's NNOMY.org. That's two N's, NNOMY.org. You are listening to Uprising, and later in the hour, we will hear from Michael Kearns. He joins us in studio to talk about his new performance, Going In, Once Upon a Time in South Africa, to commemorate International World AIDS Day this Saturday. We'll also hear about how mainstream media coverage of the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal has shown over the years to be rife with bias. And we'll hear a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal himself. But first, this radical day in history.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Kat Aaron. On this day, November 29th in 1781, the Zong Massacre claimed the lives of 132 enslaved African people. The crew of the British slave ship Zong had packed on more slaves than they had room for, causing disease and malnutrition. Upon realizing that the remaining slaves had little chance of survival, the captain ordered that the slaves be drowned in order to collect insurance on them. When they returned to England, the owners of the ship claimed the full value of the murdered slaves, who were legally considered to be physical property. This mass killing of African slaves resulted in a battle against the African slave trade of the 18th century and the eventual abolition of slavery in Britain. The Middle Passage is infamous for its inhumane conditions and the atrocious acts committed on board the ships. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Say it, say it, say it. Hi, my name is Sarkis Hazarian, and I want to serve as a member of the LSB because I want to play a role in helping KPFK achieve its goal of being a radio station that provides an alternative and progressive news and information source for the people of Southern California. I believe that the LSB has to provide the leadership to make KPFK a transparent organization that is governed in a democratic and fair process to attempt to meet the growing needs of a very diverse community. We need to find ways to reach a younger generation of listeners who have many options from which to obtain news and information. I want to be part of a team that will help KPFK become a radio station and helps people become informed about the world from a progressive perspective, utilizing objective and comprehensive news sources and individuals. I am Sarkis Hazarian, and I'm a candidate for the LSB.
Learn more about KPFK elections at pacificaelections.org. Your completed ballot must be received at the P.O. Box or the station by midnight, December 11th.
Welcome back to Uprising. We now hear from Mumia Abu-Jamal, an award-winning journalist and political prisoner. Today's radio commentary is called The Obama Factor.
The Obama Factor? Can a brother win? While the U.S. presidential election is a year away, the first wave of primaries, less than 7 weeks away, will go a long way towards determining who will be the final candidates for the election of November 2008. The presence of Barack Obama poses a powerful political conundrum. Initially, some wondered, is he black enough? This question pitched in part because of his biracial background, as the son of a white Kansas mother and a black Kenyan father. The question really gets to the central black concern. Does he get it? Does he know what our lives really are? It is an historical oddity that he emerges as a quite serious presidential contender in the same year, the same election, as the well-known wife of a former president, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, is widely regarded not merely as the front runner, but as the heir apparent of the seat vacated by her husband Bill just some 7 years ago. The early primaries in the predominantly white Northeast and Midwest will tell the tale. In Iowa, according to early reports, Obama is leading Clinton, albeit barely. The question that really dogs the Obama campaign isn't, is he black enough, but can he win? Several weeks ago, the Washington Post printed a piece on musings by black women in a South Carolina beauty shop. South Carolina is particularly relevant because it is, of all U.S. states, the blackest state, with its 30% population and nearly 50% of the state's voters. A young Obama volunteer speaks with a 50-ish accountant who expresses a view that goes much farther than the Palmetto State. I'm voting for him. I'm old school. I know what's going on. He's trying to take this country someplace it's never been before. It's going to take a lot for him to win. I know that. I know the system is not set up for him to win. It's going to take a miracle and a lot of prayers for him to win, if you can get us to vote. A recent poll released by the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies found that among African-American potential voters in the primaries and caucuses, Senator Clinton has an 84% favorable rating versus a 10% unfavorable rating. For Senator Obama, the favorable rating is 74% versus 10% unfavorable. With the 2000 election decided by less than 200 votes, it's clear that very few votes can change the outcome. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
You can listen to Mumia's audio commentaries online at www.prisonradio.org. On December 6th, NBC's Today's Show will feature a new book coinciding with its release date about death row journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. The book's title, Murdered by Mumia, reveals its intent. It is co-written by the widow of the Philadelphia police officer that Abu-Jamal was convicted of killing, Maureen Faulkner, and conservative radio talk show host Michael Smirkonish. The book, say Faulkner and Smirkonish, is, quote, the first to carefully and definitively lay out the case against Abu-Jamal and those who've elevated him to the status of political prisoner. Fearing a program rife with bias, the group Journalists for Mumia are calling on NBC to ensure that all sides are fairly represented on next week's Today Show. They contend that there has been a history of media bias with respect to covering the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Joining us on the line this morning is Hans Bennett with Journalists for Mumia. Welcome back to Uprising, Hans.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us today. So before we talk about the book and about the Today Show, let's step back and take a look at the history of how mainstream media has covered the Abu-Jamal case in the United States. Outside the U.S., of course, it's a different story. Over the years, there has been a lot of coverage, and of course, some of it has been affected by the way in which the Fraternal Order of Police, who are Mumia Abu-Jamal's nemesis, if you will, have really conspired and have done a lot of damage, if you will, to media coverage. What has the in your mind? What are some examples of how the media has covered Mumia Abu-Jamal in a way that you find troubling as a journalist?
Well, it's really all across the board, and for an overview, I'd recommend people go to the fair.org website by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. They cover a lot of stuff from over the years. One of the clearest examples was the ABC show 2020 with Sam Donaldson in 1998. Really indicative of the tone of the show was an interview with Sam Donaldson the day before in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he said that the people who support Mumia's release don't do so from a position of knowledge. They either oppose the death penalty, or they're campus radicals, or they're African-American activists who believe that a black man was railroaded and will continue to believe it no matter what's presented to them. Now, you know, if you want to look at the overt racism in that statement, you know, you have support from, you know, the most prominent black intellectuals of our generation. You got Cornel West, Henry Louis Gates Jr., Toni Morrison, you know, Angela Davis, Alice Walker, you know, Manning Marable, and the list goes on and on. And there's been a lot of documentation of this show. Covert Action Quarterly magazine did a really in-depth analysis, talked about how they, you know, would take, you know, select clips from Ed Asner and select clips from, you know, who's an actor who supports a new trial for Mumia, and then take select clips from his lawyer and really distort it around. And Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting did a good report on it. And then also there was a whole movie done about it called Framing and Execution, Mumia Abu-Jamal in the Media, and it's narrated by Danny Glover. That's really excellent. All this stuff is viewable, you know, online on our website, abujamalnews.com. So I, you know, I'd encourage people to go and check it out to, you know, learn more.
That's abujamalnews.com. Now, what about the media coverage of the recent development in the Abu Jamal case with respect to the possibility of a new trial, as well as the discovery of new photographs that could have a big impact on his case? How has the mainstream media been covering these new aspects of this case?
Well, regarding the new crime scene photos, the mainstream media has completely ignored it. I've personally contacted everyone I could think of. You know, we put together numerous press releases. I keep contacting people, along with a lot of other people who have been contacting the mainstream media, too. And it's been completely ignoring it, not one sentence even acknowledging the existence of these photos. Last month, however, David Love is a columnist for The Black Commentator, which is a national website-based news source. He wrote an excellent article about our campaign, and it got picked up by the San Francisco Bayview newspaper, which is a national black paper out of San Francisco, and they were the first ones to actually publish a photo. So that was a good step for us, but now we're really still trying to pressure the mainstream media to acknowledge them. Now, if you look at the May 17th hearings, and, you know, before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, the coverage the week of it, you know, the Inquirer and the Associated Press had articles that were relatively fair, all things considered. You know, they laid out both sides. They didn't do much in-depth, you know, investigation into the background of the case, which I think, you know, any serious journalist should do because it's such an important issue. But they weren't quite as fanatical in their distortion. But if you looked at a lot of the TV coverage in Philadelphia and other places, it was pretty bad. But then it, also, if you look back at in December 2005, when the Third Circuit Court first announced that they would begin deliberations and that they would consider two issues that were not certified by the previous judge, Federal Court Judge Yon, the media was almost completely silent, especially in Philadelphia. And, you know, that was a real travesty of justice, too, because it's a major development in the case. Lynn Washington Jr., he's a Philadelphia columnist, he wrote a good essay on it saying, you know, when the Philly media doesn't bash, it ignores. And, you know, that's exactly what happened with it this time.
Let's talk about what is expected to happen next week on the Today Show. NBC is going to be featuring this new book, Murdered by Mumia. Are they going to have both authors on as guests?
Yes, that's how it appears based on Michael Smirkanish's website, that they will have both people on. And we've been initiating our email letter writing campaign for about the last week and a half, 2 weeks. And Pam Africa, who's the head of the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia, she has a telephone conference scheduled with the Today Show for tomorrow. So it is a critical time, and if listeners are able to take, you know, literally 1 minute to send an email. We have created a form letter so it can be real quick. We're trying to get as much public support for our campaign as possible within the next day so that Pam Africa has better grounds, and when she's having her meeting with them and people know, you know, at the Today Show that the whole world's watching, and we don't want another whitewash biased report about Mumia.
So Pam Africa is meeting with NBC?
Yes.
And regarding this particular program?
Yeah, she's having a telephone conference with him about this program. And you know, to be clear, I mean, we're asking for fairness on the show. We're not asking for them to silence Maureen Faulkner or for them or for her to not be on the show. And if the Today Show is already booked, you know, on December 6th, you know, we're cool with doing it the next day or the day after that. As long as they give us equal time, that's what we really want.
Just to have some balance on the program.
Exactly.
Who could they interview?
Well, we suggested Suzanne Ross, who's the head of the New York City Coalition for Mumia, and also Philadelphia journalist Lynn Washington. And Lynn Washington is independent of us, but he is a journalist who's been covering this case for 25 years in Philadelphia, and you know, he has said Mumia needs a new trial. And we think that, you know, his reports and coverage in the past have been fair and balanced. So we were suggesting having him on the show.
I'm speaking with Hans Bennett, with Journalists for Mumia. We're talking about the Today Show next week on December 6th, which will be featuring a new book called Murdered by Mumia, and it's co-authored by Maureen Faulkner, the widow of the Philadelphia police officer that Abu Jamal was convicted of killing, and also co-written with Michael Smirkonish, a conservative radio talk show host. Let's talk about Michael Smirkonish, Hans. Who is this person? Who is this a man who is her co-author, and what can you tell us about his politics?
Well, you know, he's been around for a while, and he's probably been the most prominent journalist, you know, assisting the Fraternal Order of Police campaign to execute Mumia. And, you know, a good indication of his broader politics would be, you know, after September 11th, he wrote a book advocating racial profiling, you know, unapologetically, and, you know, saying that, you know, we don't need to let our politically correct sympathies get in the way. We shouldn't be guilty about targeting people of color and Muslims. And, you know, that says a lot right there. You know, he's smart enough that he tries to paint himself as not being a racist and whatnot. But I think that, you know, that right there shows the broader context. And also his recent book is called Muzzled, where he takes kind of a general approach to how, quote-unquote, political correctness is, you know, destroyed our society and causing all these problems.
Hmm. So he is the co-author of this book. And have you had a chance to take a look at the book at all and find out what it's about, whether, you know, how it deals with this case?
Well, no. Basically, I've requested a review copy as well as a lot of other people I know, and no one's been able to get it. They have had the first chapter available on their website showing the preview, and it basically says it's called Premonition, and it's saying how Maureen Faulkner and her family had this premonition that something bad was going to happen. And they don't really go into the facts of the case. However, there is one paragraph on the website which, you know, tries to summarize evidence, and I could read that to you. It says, Mumia Abu-Jamal was unanimously convicted of the crime by a racially mixed jury based on the testimony of several eyewitnesses, his ownership of the murder weapon, matching ballistics, and Abu Jamal's own confession. And if you want me to pick out one of those things, I could talk about the, you know, alleged ownership of the murder weapon and matching ballistics.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I mean, there's also the issue of the supposed confession.
Oh, yeah. And it's amazing that they're still citing this confession, because it's one of the probably the most easy thing to discredit. I mean, these police officers allegedly forgot about the confession for 2 months. And, you know, one of the police officers who said he heard it had reported in his official police report that the Negro male made no comment.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, at the original 1982 trial, when Mumia's lawyer tried to bring in Gary Wakeshold, the officer who made the Negro male remark, he tried to bring him into the court on the last day, but the judge wouldn't allow it, saying it was too late, you know, in the time. And he said, you and your attorney goofed. You know, that's a direct quote from the trial judge, you know, Albert Hanging Judge Sabo.
Well, unfortunately, Hans, we are out of time. I'm sure our listeners can do their research into the very, very well-documented ways in which the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal has been very, very flawed. And again, that website where they can, if they're interested in writing to NBC about next week's show, where can they find a sample letter?
Well, they can go to the main Mumia website, which is freemumia.com. That's out of New York City and is a family and friends website. And then general background, my website, Journalist for Mumia, is abujamalnews.com.
AbuJamalNews.com and FreeMumia.com. Hans, thank you so much for joining us again. I'm sure we'll have you back on to continue covering this case.
Great. Thank you very much.
Hans Bennett is with Journalists for Mumia. You are listening to Uprising, and after this week's Peace Vigil announcements, we'll hear from Michael Kearns, activist and artist, about his new performance commemorating International World AIDS Day. Stay tuned.
Hello, my name is Lick Doan, and I'm running for KPFK's local station board. Being an avid listener sponsor, I depend heavily on KPFK for honest, reliable, alternative news that's untainted by corporate influence and money. KPFK has broadened my worldview and understanding of social problems. As an activist in the community, I coordinate rallies and teach-ins against U.S. imperialism in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Bosnia. I also organize to protect civil rights and fight racism. As the son of immigrants, I am conscious of defending immigrant rights while seeking compromises and solutions. Currently, I volunteer as co-producer for Ian Masters on his show, Background Briefing. I am running for the LSB because I am concerned about the internal turmoil at KPFK and the station losing touch with its listeners. I hope to build bridges within here, diversify programming, enact HD radio, bring about fiscal responsibility, and uphold the Pacifica mission. Once again, my name is Lick Doan, and please vote for me for the LSB.
Learn more about KPFK elections at pacificaelections.org. Your completed ballot must be received at the P.O. Box or the station by midnight, December 11th.
It's time for our weekly Peace Vigil announcements. I'm Gabriel San Roman. Neighborhood activists all over Southern California hold regular peace vigils to end the war in Iraq. Each week we announce just some of the 50-plus vigils that are taking place. Complete listings of all the vigils are available at www.neighborsforpeaceandjustice.org or www.peacevigils.com. On Fridays in Atwater, there's a peace vigil from 5 to 6:30 p.m. on the corner of Glendale Boulevard and Glen Feliz. The information line is 213-250-5500. Again, that's 213-250-5500. On Fridays in Costa Mesa, Santana, there's a peace vigil from 5 to 7 p.m. on the corner of Bristol and Anton in front of the major entrance to the South Coast Plaza. The information line is area code 714-956-5037. Again, that's 714-956-5037. On Fridays in Pasadena, from 5 to 6:30 p.m., there's a peace vigil on South Lake at the corner of Lake Avenue and Del Mar Avenue. The email contact is rsmoak2@yahoo.com. Again, that's rsmoak2@yahoo.com. On Fridays in Riverside, from 6 to 7 p.m., there's a peace vigil on the corner of University and Iowa. The information line is 951-653-0743. Or go to rapja.org, that's rapja.org. On Sundays in Torrance from noon to 2 p.m., there's a peace vigil at Hawthorne Boulevard in Artesia at the 91 Freeway. The information line is 310-372-9505. Again, that's 310-372-9505. On Sundays in Whittier from 6 to 8 p.m., there's a peace vigil on the corner of Whittier Boulevard and Painter. The information line is 562-692-2621. Again, that's 562-692-2621. And finally, on Wednesdays in West Los Angeles from 7:30 to 8:30 p.m., there's a peace vigil on the corner of Westwood Boulevard and National, diagonal from Trader Joe's. A complete list of vigils is available at www.neighborsforpeaceandjustice.org or www.peacevigils.com. Special thanks to Jennifer Hiller.
Welcome back to Uprising. About 2.5 million people have been newly infected with the HIV/AIDS virus this year. It is now estimated that more than 33 million people globally live with HIV. An overwhelming 95% of all HIV/AIDS cases occur in the developing world. The theme of this year's International World AIDS Day on Saturday, December 1st, is leadership and calls upon various sectors of society, not just governments, to address the AIDS challenge. Locally, as part of World AIDS Day, actor and activist Michael Kearns will be premiering a one-time performance reading of Going In, Once Upon a Time in South Africa. Kearns' newest work is a spoken memoir reflecting on the month he spent with his daughter working in an orphanage in Johannesburg. Going In explores issues of HIV/AIDS, gender, and poverty. And Michael Kearns joins me live in studio this morning. Welcome to Uprising, Michael.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks very much for joining us. So this performance is going to be at Highways Performance Space, and we'll give out that information. But tell us a little bit more about that. When were you in Johannesburg, and what did you learn there, particularly about HIV and AIDS?
We were there in August, primarily. And
of this year?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And what I learned more than anything, I think, is the emotional fortitude of these people, a population that is, you would think, completely hopeless. They seem to redeem themselves on a daily basis. And I think that the country's force of trying to make sense of their lives and forging ahead in the midst of what is unsurmountable odds is so just redemptive. And I think that that's the thing that people go to South Africa and they come back and they say they loved South Africa. And you think, what? They loved South Africa? I mean, it's so fraught with so many tragic circumstances and day-to-day challenges. Yet, there's something about it that's just infectious in its activism, I think is the word. Mm. It's an activist country. Mm. And that's what
certainly.
I really took from the experience, not only about HIV/AIDS, but about issues around poverty and women's issues, particularly women's issues, and race, obviously. I mean, apartheid was 13 years ago, the end of apartheid, supposedly, yet apartheid is still very much a part of the fabric of the country. Obviously, 13 years is a teensy period of time.
Why did you go?
Well, I've dealt so thoroughly with HIV/AIDS, if one can deal with HIV/AIDS thoroughly in any city or country in America, and specifically in Los Angeles, that I just wanted to – really what I said was that I wanted to hold some of those babies. And that, if I distilled it, I would say that that was it, you know, that I wanted to see and touch and feel and smell what it was like there without, you know, one can only get so much from a newspaper article or from a newsreel on TV. I wanted to really breathe it. And then I wanted to come back and report it, which I think is my job. That's the title of the piece, is Going In. Ryan Milan wrote a beautiful book about when he was a journalist there, a white journalist, going into the townships and going in to various places. And he said that all the journalists would say, we're going in today. Hmm. We're going in to Soweto, or we're going in. So that's the title. And that's what I felt that I did. I decided to go in as opposed to sort of looking at it from afar. Hmm. And it was just an extraordinary experience.
Can you share a piece of this performance?
I would love
on
to.
Our
yes.
Airwaves?
The August winds have officially arrived, expressing their tempestuousness. It is freezing this morning, so cold that utter strangers, as we pass each other on the streets, strangers who would likely not have spoken to each other under other circumstances, mutter, almost as a greeting, cold. I respond, cold. On that we all agreed. The air is dense with clouds of smoke drifting out of homes with fireplaces, many without electricity, and it smells like a raging forest fire. This is my last day with teacher Josephine at Park Junior, as we work with the children on an art project that incorporates playing with letters of the alphabet. She and I seize every possible moment to strengthen our soon-to-be-truncated friendship. We have a limited time to infuse each other with what we know, what we believe, and what we feel. I was teaching at a Soweto high school in 1984 when my girls started dropping like flies. I wanted to bring it out into the open, but no one would ever listen. Many believed and still believe that AIDS is a white man's disease, she says. Condoms aren't for black men. When the 27-year-old son of her sister, my own flesh and blood, she says, was dying, all her siblings would admit is that he was ill. When Josephine saw him, she was aghast. A skeleton, she says, without emotion. He died 3 months later. In the obituary, the grieving aunt truthfully indicated that her nephew died of AIDS. I wanted people to know what can happen, she tells me. My sister became hysterical. You killed him, she said. He did not die of HIV. You killed him with your lies. When Josephine decided that she could no longer endure abuse from her husband, the mother of three children sought the counsel of her church pastor. He insisted that they remain married. The pastor will always side with the man, she says. In 1991, she left him and was promptly disowned by her family members, who provided no support, emotionally or financially, letting their own flesh and blood live in a shelter for a year. Survival of the fittest, she reminds me. Don't forget that this is a black woman speaking to a white man, sharing confidences that impugn her race. She was beginning to hold meetings for women in her church, nurturing them to come out about HIV/AIDS. The wife of the pastor got it from her husband, she remembers, a man of the cloth. Josephine barely takes a breath as the kid's rowdiness escalates. Another woman was barren. Her husband's mother informed her daughter-in-law that she must allow her son to have sex outside of the marriage. That corner, that corner, that corner, she says, pointing in three directions, indicating the intersection of a street corner. All children by this man. All with AIDS. The stories don't stop there. The debasing shame is so great that suicide is commonplace. One young girl, she says, put turpentine on her head and set herself on fire. Even today, she reports, if someone in a rural area let it be known that they are HIV positive, they would be stoned to death. How can I not confide in teacher Josephine that I am HIV positive? When I do, her response needs no extravagant words. She offers the gravitas of support with her unflinching gaze. No one has HIV in South Africa, she says sarcastically. Funeral after funeral. You bake a cake for the family, but you don't talk about it. Bake a cake, don't talk about it. Bake a cake, don't talk about it. Bake a cake, don't talk about it. I tell her about my experiences as the school bell threatens to end our intimacies. I want to share three words with you that I have held close during the past 25 years, I say. Taking a pencil from her desk, I ask her for a piece of paper. On it, I write, silence equals death. She reads the words, takes a deep breath that telegraphs both dismay and relief. I'm going, she announces, to write a book. Josephine is my sister. My activist sister.
Michael Kearns, artist, activist. Thank you so much. That was a piece of the performance he's going to be doing this Saturday called Going In Once Upon a Time in South Africa. It sounds like you were very profoundly affected.
I really was. You can see. I mean, I had this short relationship with this woman, and I think that we changed each other's lives in some way.
Now, let me just give information for our listeners. Again, it's happening this Saturday, December 1st at 8:30 p.m. The performance will be at Highways Performance Space, 1651 18th Street in Santa Monica. Again, that's this Saturday at 8:30 p.m. And for information and tickets, you can call 310-315-1459. That's 310-315-1459. You can also visit highwaysperformance.org. And for KPFK listener sponsors, we have two pairs of tickets to give to the show on Saturday. If you call us at 818-985-KPFK, the first two callers and a friend can go and check out Michael Kearns and hear the entire performance. Again, that's 818-985-KPFK. Now, Michael, there's also going to be photography at this performance?
Yes, ACT UP is doing an evening the night before mine on November 30th, which is protest photography from the days of ACT UP, celebrating their 20th anniversary, in fact. And then there will be also some performance. Ian McKinnon is doing a poem, and Tori Osborne will be there. They will be discussing how ACT UP has continually affected the landscape of HIV/AIDS in Los Angeles particularly.
And so that's on Friday. But the photography exhibit is for both days.
Yes, absolutely. And then also my daughter's photography and Molly Lowry's photography will be part of my show. So that's another photo exhibit of the South Africa experiences that we had. Oh, my 13-year-old, who was then 12, took some incredible, extraordinary photos.
And she was the one who accompanied you on this trip.
Yes.
How did this?
And my friend Molly Lowry.
Does the character of your daughter figure into your performance?
Very much so. I mean, to watch her experience this through her eyes and to see her maturation process just blossom under the circumstances. She spent almost every day with the AIDS babies, taking care of them, changing their diapers, loving them, playing with them, feeding them. It was amazing. And this is a kid who was adopted. So she's mothering in a way that she never had. I mean, she had mothering from me, but she didn't have a mother. And it was fascinating to see that. And she's also black. So you can see that it's a rich tapestry we wove when we were there.
Now, Michael, just broadly speaking, you know, you've been doing this for a long time. Do you have hope? It's International World AIDS Day again, and the statistics just don't sound like they're getting better necessarily. I mean, maybe we're not hearing about the good news, but is there any good news?
Well, do I have hope? I have to have hope, and I think that that's one of the things that I was re-energized by South Africa, because those people have hope under circumstances which are dire. My circumstances and the circumstances of those of us living in America are not nearly as bad. They certainly are in some areas of America, and our circumstances are bad for other reasons. But I think that we still have a long road to travel in terms of conquering this disease. And I think that there is still a lot of judgment, and I think that there's a lot of homophobia and racism and sex phobia and all kinds of things that continue after 26 years to keep us from really opening ourselves to issues that swirl around HIV/AIDS. I mean, what's fascinating to me about HIV/AIDS, and always has been fascinating, is that it really does bring up every ism we know, racism, sexism, classism, and those issues are magnified. The negative aspects of those issues are magnified. I mean, we have to do this work for many reasons that encompass HIV/AIDS. It's just the work that we have to do, and you know, God knows we need a different president to do it.
Well, Michael, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Congratulations on this new performance and best of luck to you.
Thanks so much, Sonali.
Again, Michael Kearns, artist and activist, the piece that he's going to be performing this Saturday, December 1st at 8:30 p.m. at Highways Performance Space is called Going In, Once Upon a Time in South Africa. Highways Performance Space is at 1651 18th Street in Santa Monica. And for tickets, you can call 310-315-1459 or visit highwaysperformance.org. Congratulations to our two listeners, two of the listeners, many of you who called in, and congratulations to those two who won tickets. I hope you enjoy the show. For Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day, I'd like to quote Greg Gonzalez from a speech at the 2006 Toronto AIDS Conference, who said, AIDS is essentially a crisis of governance, of what governments do and do not do for their people. We have demanded too little from our leaders, excused far too much. That's Greg Gonzalez. That's Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's program after 10 a.m. on our website at uprisingradio.org. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks for listening.